This is Warren Throckmorton, and you're listening to the Telling Jefferson Lies podcast. In Episode 5, Whitewashing Jefferson Part 1, I promised a bonus episode on Sally Hemings. Today, I am making good on that promise. Michael Coulter and I adapted our section in our book Getting Jefferson Right for this episode. Coulter narrates the segment. We also offer brief comment from an interview I conducted with Anna Burks, Manager of Public Services and Collection Development at the Research Library at Monticello. Sally Hemings was born sometime in 1773. The child of John Wales and his enslaved woman, Elizabeth Hemings. John Wales was a farmer, lawyer, and slave trader, and Thomas Jefferson's father-in-law. Jefferson married Wales' daughter, Martha. Sally Hemings and Martha Jefferson were half-sisters. Hemings came to Monticello as a toddler when John Wales died and left enslaved people, property, and debt to the Jeffersons. According to Monticello, Hemings had at least 6 children, fathered by Jefferson. Only 4 lived to adulthood. Eventually, Jefferson freed all of Sally Hemings' children. Beverly and Harriet left Monticello in the early 1820s. Madison and Esten were freed in his will and left Monticello in 1826. Jefferson did not free members of any other enslaved family. As we say in the book, Barton acts as Jefferson's defense attorney and sometimes his fixer, altering the evidence. When he brought out the second edition of the Jefferson Lies, he continued to maintain that there was no evidence that Jefferson fathered any of Sally Hemings' children.
I speak at universities, law schools across America, and I have a question I have a lot of fun asking. I will look at these young kids who have been born in the last 18, 19, 20 years, and I will ask them, how many of you have been told that Thomas Jefferson fathered children through his slave Sally Hemings? Every university, 95% of the hands go up. That's interesting because that story only broke in 1998, November of 1998. Most of you weren't even born at that point in time, and you're being told by your professors a story. I said, now, what if that story is not true? And it came out, they announced DNA testing proved that, but what if you learned that they didn't even use Jefferson's DNA when they tested? Would that change your opinion of Jefferson? And what if you learned that when the story came out, 200 news outlets carried it nationally, but then 6 weeks later they retracted the story and said, oops, sorry, DNA evidence. Have you heard anything about the retraction? If you had heard that there was a retraction of the DNA evidence, would it change your opinion of how you thought about Thomas Jefferson? And you just start going through what actually happened. It is interesting to see how people change their perception of Jefferson based on something that was wrongly told them from 2 decades ago, that when you look at the facts, there's no evidence that what was said 2 decades ago is true, and that's why the evidence was pulled 2 decades ago.
Barton's main distraction is to point out that DNA from Jefferson's line was not used. However, this was not a barrier to discovering the potential Jefferson males who could have been the father, since DNA from Jefferson's uncle was used. Barton actually knows this, but he is content to simply cast doubt by repeating the fact that Thomas Jefferson's DNA was not used. Barton also says the Nature article was retracted, but that's misleading too. In the follow-up article, Eugene Foster, the scientist who did the analysis, urged caution, but maintained that Thomas Jefferson was one of the possible Jefferson fathers of Hemings' children. Here's Michael Coulter.
In the first edition, we did not take up the controversy over the possibility that Jefferson fathered children with his enslaved woman, Sally Hemings. In both editions of The Jefferson Lies, David Barton provides a spirited defense of Jefferson, which reads like a legal brief in defense of a client. He examines the controversy over DNA testing, oral tradition which identifies Jefferson as the father of Hemings' children, and rumors in the press at the time that Jefferson was alive, and decides these lines of evidence are flawed. Barton concludes, quote, therefore, none of these 3 sources of evidence, often invoked against Jefferson, the DNA testing, oral tradition, or the early published claims of Callender provide any credible basis for believing that Jefferson fathered any of Hemings' children. Nevertheless, attempts to convict Jefferson not only continue, but have even expanded into new venues, end quote. In our first edition, we did not take up the claim because we believed at the time that the issues raised by it were beyond the scope of our expertise. We also believe that people on both sides of the question could disagree for good reasons. In hindsight, we were wrong not to comment on the matter. We should have objected to and exposed the tendentious approach Barton used to examine the topic. Let us say clearly at the outset that we believe that the evidence supports the belief that Jefferson fathered one or more of Sally Hemings' children. The recent discovery of Sally Hemings' quarters within Monticello has added to the evidence that Jefferson treated her differently than other enslaved people. Barton's second edition came out before this discovery. In Barton's writings and public statements about the Hemings matter, he has not commented on this discovery as far as we can determine. Currently, the opinion of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation is, quote, "While there are some who disagree, the Foundation's scholarly advisors and the larger community of academic historians who specialize in early American history have concurred for many years that the evidence is sufficiently strong to state that Thomas Jefferson fathered at least six children with Sally Hemings," end quote. As the Foundation report states, a minority of scholars view the evidence differently. Readers are urged to consult the Foundation report and is linked in the show notes. For our purposes, we want to examine the extent to which Barton will go to make his case in defense of Jefferson. To do this, we will refer to the three lines of evidence Barton claims he refutes in order to defend his client: DNA evidence, the oral tradition saying Jefferson fathered Hemings' children, and news accounts, rumors, and factual observations while Jefferson was in public life. First, DNA evidence. When it comes to the DNA evidence, Barton summarizes the DNA analysis conducted by Eugene Foster in 1998 and published in Nature. Barton is correct that there are other Jefferson males besides Thomas Jefferson who could have fathered Hemings' children based on the DNA testing conducted by Foster. He is also correct that Nature later published an article which urged caution in interpreting the results produced by Foster. However, one very clear finding from the report remains true. Quote, "The results of DNA tests conducted by Dr. Eugene Foster and a team of geneticists in 1998 challenged the view that the Jefferson-Hemings relationship could be either refuted nor substantiated. The study, which tested Y-chromosomal DNA samples from male line descendants of Field Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson's uncle, John Carr, grandfather of Jefferson's Carr nephews, Easton Hemings, and Thomas Woodson, indicated a genetic link between the Jefferson and Hemings descendants. The results of the study established that an individual carrying the male Jefferson Y chromosome fathered Easton Hemings, born in 1808, the last known child born to Sally Hemings," end quote. None of the distraction Barton offers can change this. Thomas Jefferson is a candidate for paternity, and since no one can analyze any additional relevant Jefferson DNA, there are no known male descendants available, there is no additional way DNA can be helpful. We are left to examine circumstantial evidence. Oral tradition. Oral tradition is strong in support of Jefferson being the father of Sally Hemings' children. One of the key sources of evidence is a newspaper article attributed to Madison Hemings. Madison moved to Pike County, Ohio in 1835 and worked as a farmer and a carpenter. Barton, as Jefferson's defense attorney, goes to work to discredit Hemings as a witness. In the second edition of The Jefferson Lies, Barton says this about Madison Hemings. Quote, "The other major oral tradition challenging Jefferson's sexual morality came from Sally Hemings' son, Madison, the fourth Hemings child, born in 1805. In an article published in an Ohio newspaper in 1873, Madison Hemings claimed that in France, quote, "My mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine, and when he was called back home, she was enceinte, or pregnant, by him, with Thomas Woodson." But the DNA testing disproved two of Madison Hemings' major claims. One, there were no Jefferson genes in Sally's first child, Thomas. Therefore, two, Sally did not return home pregnant by Jefferson. End of that quote. Now, however, Barton changed a key component of what Madison Hemings recorded in the Pike County newspaper article. Madison Hemmings did say that his mother was pregnant, but he did not say that his mother was pregnant with Thomas Woodson. Notice where Barton stops the quote from Hemmings' news article. He stops the quote after the words, "and sent by him." Barton inserted the name Thomas Woodson after the quote closed. Madison Hemmings never said that name. Hemmings said in the article that his mother's baby died in infancy. Let us repeat. Madison Hemmings never claimed his mother's baby was Thomas Woodson. Barton includes that name, apparently, because there was an oral tradition that a man named Thomas Woodson was the son of Hemmings and Jefferson. However, DNA testing ruled out a Jefferson male in the Woodson line. Monticello's researchers acknowledge this, but that claim is not relevant to the claim of Madison Hemmings. He never named Woodson or implied that Sally Hemmings had a child that lived when she returned from France. Barton had to make up something Madison Hemmings did not say in order to disprove it. In fact, Barton did not disprove Madison Hemmings' claim. Compare what Madison Hemmings wrote and what Barton wrote in his book. Here is Madison's account. He, that is Jefferson, left for France taking his eldest daughter with him. He had had sons born to him, but they died in early infancy. So he then had but two children, Martha and Maria. The latter was left at home, but was afterwards ordered to follow him to France. She was 3 years or so younger than Martha. My mother accompanied her as her body servant. When Mr. Jefferson went to France, Martha was a young woman, grown. My mother was about her age, and Maria was just budding into womanhood. Their stay, my mother and Maria's, was about 18 months. But during that time, my mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine. When he was called home, she was incensed by him. He desired to bring my mother back to Virginia with him, but she demurred. She was just beginning to understand the French language well, and in France, she was free. Well, if she returned to Virginia, she would be re-enslaved. So she refused to return to induce her to do so. He promised her extraordinary privileges and made a solemn pledge that her children should be freed at the age of 21 years. In consequence of his promises, on which she implicitly relied, she returned with him to Virginia. Soon after their arrival, she gave birth to a child, of whom Thomas Jefferson was the father. It lived but a short time. She gave birth to four others, and Jefferson was the father of all of them. Their names were Beverly, Harriet, Madison, myself, and Easton, three sons and one daughter. We all became free agreeably to the treaty entered into by our parents before we were born. We all married and raised families. End quote. Note that the only enslaved people freed by Jefferson were members of Hemmings' family, just as Madison Hemmings said Jefferson promised his mother. Barton quotes Hemmings saying, quote, "But during that time, my mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine. And when he was called home, she was incensed by him." He adds Thomas Woodson's name. Hemmings never mentioned Woodson, but instead said the child died in infancy. Even defense attorneys are supposed to tell the truth, even if they slant it a little. Here Barton cooks the evidence to favor the outcome he seeks. News accounts, rumors, and circumstances. Barton spends most of his space criticizing one of Jefferson's chief accusers, James T. Callender. Callender was once an ally of Jefferson who took up the cause of Jefferson's party against the Federalist. However, when Jefferson failed to appoint Callender to be postmaster of Richmond, Virginia, Callender mounted a campaign of criticism and defamation against him. Barton's tactic to combat the contemporaneous rumors that Jefferson fathered children with Hemmings is to beat Callender's dead horse. That is easy to do. Callender probably was a sensationalist and may have created some false stories about Jefferson and others in order to advance his own claims. However, Callender was not the only source of stories floating around about Jefferson's relationship with Hemmings. In his chapter on Hemmings, Barton fails to mention the observation of Elijah Fletcher, who said, "The story of Black Sal is no farce. That he cohabits with her and has a number of children by her is a sacred truth." Thomas Randolph made conflicting statements, but one of them was, She, that is Hemings, had children which resembled Mr. Jefferson so closely that it was plain that they had his blood in their veins. The opinion of Jefferson's friend John Hartwell Cocke, who believed the relationship had taken place. There is correlation between Jefferson's presence at Monticello and the conception windows for Hemings' known children. The point is not that those witnesses and circumstances completely prove Jefferson's guilt. The point is that Barton failed to consider them, or he considered them but chose not to include them. As we noted in the beginning, reasonable people look at the evidence and come away with conflicting conclusions. However, one case that has been made, Barton has proven to be a biased witness. If anything, he has hidden and tampered with the evidence, and for that crime against history, we find him guilty.
I want to emphasize the level of misconduct perpetrated by David Barton. Just one more of many reasons why you have to check his claims. He added Thomas Woodson to a quote by Madison Hemings when Hemings never mentioned Woodson. This changed the meaning completely. How could Barton not know he was doing that? He had Hemings' news article. He quoted from it. He knows that Hemings said his mother's first child, quote, lived but a short time, end quote. And he knows that Thomas Woodson grew to an old age, and that Madison Hemings didn't name him. He also knows that Monticello ruled him out, that is, Thomas Woodson, as biologically related, which isn't even relevant to Madison Hemings' newspaper article, since Madison doesn't point to Woodson. Barton is the one who confuses the matter. In the show notes, I provide the relevant portion of Hemings' article and the quote from Barton's book. You can compare. I asked Anna Burks what the position of Monticello and the Thomas Jefferson Foundation is on the subject. She left no doubt in her reply.
The short answer is no. It's accepted pretty much as fact now. There is actually quite a lot of evidence from various avenues. So we do have documentary evidence. We have statistical evidence. There's the DNA evidence, which detractors argue, well, it's, as you mentioned, the DNA is not from Jefferson himself. The DNA was actually obtained from male descendants of Jefferson's paternal uncle, Field Jefferson. And at the time that the testing was done in 1998, only one line of descendants of Hemings' descendants agreed to be tested. So those were descendants of Eston Hemings. And so at the time, I think that Jefferson, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, felt that they had to be very precise and careful about this. And so they produced a statement being we believe that Jefferson fathered at least one. And that was a reference to, over time since then, come to be accepted. And this is also, I think, a reality that is becoming more recognized as well, that this was just very common on Southern plantations. And there's a lot of reason to believe that it did happen and very little reason to believe that it did not happen. So Monticello has come to reinforce that statement. And essentially now we believe, yes, there's no question. Monticello has really crystallized their stance on this. And again, there's really not a whole lot of question about this anymore. And usually people who are questioning it they're not necessarily in the mainstream.
You've been listening to Telling Jefferson Lies, a podcast series chronicling how history can be hijacked for ideological purposes. The closing song today is Were You There? By Lo-Fi Hymnal. The series is nearing an end and will conclude by the last week of April. Currently, additional episodes are in production and release dates are uncertain. Thematically, I'm concluding with an examination of the negatives of Christian nationalism and the benefits of the separation of church and state. Stay tuned and thanks for listening.